Another day of coronavirus continuing coverage right here on Connecticut Today on WICC for midweek Wednesday, April the 8th. We chatted with our sports maven, Aaron Johnson, on the program about the impact of having no sports anywhere in America. What are the long-term implications of that? We, of course, covered the live address from Connecticut Governor Ned Lamont, the daily COVID-19 update. And we spoke with a Quinnipiac University professor about the implications of Bernie Sanders dropping out of the presidential race. One of the guys that used to be behind the board a few months back, and a guy that we used to talk about, who I used to talk about with while the commercials were on, we would talk invariably about one of two things, food or sports. I'm pretty sure we're still well associated with food, him and I. But, man, there is no sports going on. Here's the Connoisseur Media sports maven, Aaron Johnson. Aaron, how are you, man?
Hey, Paul, how's everything going?
I'm eating, man. I hope you're still eating. Food.
Oh, trust me, I already got something in the oven waiting for me as soon as we finish up here.
Aaron, now the producer of the Anna and Raven show on Star 99.9. There's nothing going on, man. I mean, there's nothing going on. Did you ever think that there'd be a time, yeah, you know, a sports league goes on strike every so often. Their guys are in unions. We know that. That happens. But there is nothing going on.
It's really unprecedented on so many different levels, obviously with everyone that's been sick. But that was like the first real occurrence to me that this was serious when the NBA went on their suspension. Because I said, I remember sitting down on the couch and hearing about Rudy Gobert from the Utah Jazz and then Donovan Mitchell from the Utah Jazz, someone that played their high school ball for a couple years in Connecticut. And it was so shocking. I mean, I've talked to my friends, I've talked to my siblings, I've talked to my dad, all of us huge sports buffs, and I mean, I can only watch so many NBA classics, so many MLB highlights. It's starting to come out of my ears at this point.
Right, you watch that NBA stuff and you say, it's awfully funny without that three-point circle, right?
Yeah, the black and white starts to, you know, hurt the eyes a little bit. You know, I'm on the younger side, so too much black and white isn't good for the health.
And you're watching the NBA back, unlike today's NBA, where everybody's kissing each other and loving each other. Man, I want to play with you. No, you're watching the NBA from a time where guys genuinely despised and hated each other.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I'm watching a lot of games where our old friend Cornbread Maxwell and a lot of those boys where, you know, a forearm shiver was a love tap back in the day. So, and like I said, I was talking to my dad yesterday, and I was talking to him about, you know, trying to figure out what he's watching. And it's so bad, I said, I tried to walk him through setting up, you know, Hulu and Netflix on his smart TV. And needless to say, that didn't go over too well.
Oh, no.
But even then, he was watching old college football games, old college football highlights. And that's really what all of us can do right now is just try and go back and reminisce about a time when we actually had sports. We were supposed to be in the middle of baseball season right now. And I've watched so many Yankee highlights that, again, it's coming out of my ears.
And you know, Aaron, I mentioned going into this, you know, no matter what kind of a day anybody in any business ever had, whether it's radio, media, banking, real estate, teaching, firefighter, policeman, if you had a lousy day, you could say, screw it all, you get home, you'd microwave something, you put your feet up, and you'd put a game on, and within 10 minutes, okay, you still had the problem, but you felt a little better. We don't have that right now.
Exactly. It's that escapism that a lot of different things like sports would give us. I mean, like I said, we're supposed to be in the middle of the baseball season right now. A lot of people would. They would get off the train or they would get home after work, after sitting in traffic for 2 hours to get home, and they put on the Yankees, put on the Mets, put on the Red Sox, and that would be their escapism for even 2 hours. I mean, right now we're supposed to be in the middle of the NBA playoffs. I believe the NHL playoffs should be going on right now.
Yep.
And Major League Baseball. So you have people that would watch the Islanders, maybe the Rangers if they made the playoffs. You got guys, people that are watching, you know, the NBA playoffs where the early rounds have a game on every night. And so that escapism is lost, and we're stuck in a situation now where we're just trying for some kind of semblance of reality here, because this isn't, for the average sports fan, this is something that is so, you know, out of the realm of thought that it is difficult.
The only people, Aaron, will be doing nothing would be Knicks fans. They'd be cutting the lawn at night while everybody else is Watch him.
Yeah, no, me and the other Knicks fans about now, we're already looking at our draft picks for 3 years from now. That's really what we're doing. We know that we're not going to have any sniff of the playoffs anytime soon. So we're really looking down. I'm actually about to start scouting some high school guys.
Oh, geez.
Coming to the NBA in about 5 years. The Knicks might have a shot at. That's where I'm at with Knicks.
I got to talk to your girlfriend, man, because that's just desperate. That is desperation lane right there. You know, did you read that story, Aaron, that came out, I guess, yesterday or early today, where baseball is thinking of playing a limited schedule or their entire season in Arizona, in the smaller parks there, in the spring training sites, if the players' union would okay it? What do you think of that?
I saw some things on that, and my biggest fear about that, obviously, is one, if somebody gets sick, and what are their plans going to be? They would have to put something in place well in advance for, you know, those contingencies. And also, they would have to try and get the players to understand that they're going to be stuck out in the desert in Arizona for maybe 3 months to play a regular season out, or at least a revised regular season out. And I don't know if they're going to really be able to get that over on the players union. Players union, which is really the strongest union in the country in Major League Baseball. But it's going to be a tough sell for me. At this point, I think if nothing changes over the next, I'd say, 3 weeks as we start to get into May, it's going to be difficult to see if a season even does happen. And that's going to be something that, again, that it's going to be hard to fathom. No baseball in the middle of summer.
Aaron, one of your old fans, I believe, is on the phone. He wants to say hi to you. It's Chuck from Naugatuck. Chuck. Oh, no, Chuck's not there. He'll call back. Okay. So no baseball, no NBA, no NHL. And the other thing about baseball, Aaron, not just the major leagues, but think about the dozens and dozens and dozens of minor league teams. You know, the Hartford Yard Goats, you have a scenario there where, you know, you had a team that banged out that stadium almost every night for 70 games over the past couple of years, lost revenue there, and, you know, a loss of money for people who are doing stuff like selling concessions.
That's something that I know that Major League Baseball's brass has to be a little bit worried about. And it's something that I've thought about, too, because when you look at and you talk about the Yard Goats out in Hartford, and you look at some of these other smaller minor league parks and teams, first of all, these guys that are on the teams already aren't making a bunch of money. They're trying to get to the show. And then you talk about the concessions. That's going to be something that when we see all these teams, like the major league teams, putting up money for their concession workers, they have the ability to do that. Some of these, and a lot of these minor league teams, although they're under the umbrella of the major league organizations, I don't know if they're going to be able to do that. And so that's going to leave a big hole in the people that, like you said, that are working concessions, the guys that are going up and down the aisles with the peanuts and the Cracker Jacks and all of that kind of thing. It's a scary situation for people that usually during the summer, whether it's a teenager or an adult, work at these fields.
Yeah, one problem, no sports, nothing, nada, zip during the coronavirus outbreak. Few more minutes with the guy who used to produce this program, still with the company at the Star 99.9, our connoisseur media sports maven, Aaron Johnson. Aaron, you know, talking about Major League Baseball, and you and I used to discuss this on and off the air. Major League Baseball is worried. They have been worried for years. The average Major League Baseball fan, I think, is about 55 years old. Although you and I may know a lot of young people who are, you know, into baseball. As compared to the NFL and the NBA, baseball is trailing badly with young fans. And also, young African-American fans, the numbers of African-Americans involved in the game is lower than it was even 10 or 15 years ago. So if you're in the front office at Major League Baseball, losing an entire season to whatever, even though it's a valid reason to have to lose a season, maybe, they have to be having nightmares over this.
Absolutely. I mean, this is something that not only would be a worst case scenario, but also, like you said, a worst nightmare. A lot of my friends, and I'm turning 28 years old in a couple months. A lot of my friends haven't watched baseball for as long as I know them. Same thing when I talk to my siblings. A lot of their friends don't watch baseball. They don't. If you played it, it's one thing. If you played it growing up, Little League, Pony League, whatever it may be, it's one thing. But if you don't really play it, and you played football, you played soccer, you played basketball, baseball is not something that's even on your radar outside of maybe the New York Yankees, and that's only specifically in this area. It is something that I know Major League Baseball has definitely tried to rectify. They've had a bunch of different programs where it's focused on the inner city to try and build their love of baseball back up for some of the youth in the inner cities. But, I mean, I talked to you and I talked to my dad of teams back in the 70s and 80s that had all types of minorities on the teams. And it was, you know, people that were black, people that were Hispanic, people that were white, and they were all playing together. And now it has dwindled so much in the inner cities that it's really startling. And this is definitely not a situation that's going to help those numbers at all.
Precisely. I mean, if you look at back when I was growing up and you could go to any major league team, you know, like the Pittsburgh Pirates, who had guys like Dave Parker and Willie Stargell and Rennie Stanitor, even the Yankees. Yeah, exactly. And that was a groundbreaking team. One of the additions of that team, somebody realized one day on the bench, it was in the early 70s, they were the first team to ever start 9 African-American players in one game. You had the Yankees with Roy White and Reggie Jackson and Willie Randolph. But now it's mainly pulling back to a white/Latino game. And you know, if you're going to lose a whole season, I mean, that's going to be disastrous. So I'm thinking, Aaron, I don't know, maybe if baseball, maybe late in the year, just to say they did something, I don't know if they, you know, maybe you don't hold a World Series, but I don't know if you do some sort of a round robin exhibition thing, or you get, you know, maybe if the coronavirus thing is down low enough or under control enough where you would just play some exhibition games nationally and televise those. I don't know what you do here.
And one of the big things that I've seen, especially in other sports, when you look at Major League Baseball, is that social media is obviously a big component here. And when you look at some of the top players in the NFL, if Tom Brady walks down the street, everybody knows who Tom Brady is. Mm-hmm. In Major League Baseball, in the NBA, if LeBron James walks down the street, you know it's LeBron James. Mike Trout could walk down any street in America outside of Los Angeles, and no one's even going to know it's Mike Trout.
He could be the guy serving you at McDonald's in Fairfield, and nobody would know it's the best baseball player on the planet.
No one. And that's something that really is an issue that they have to rectify, whether it's doing more on social media like I talk about. One guy that I really love is Tim Anderson, the shortstop from the Chicago White Sox. He's African-American. He won the batting title last year, and I don't think a lot of people know who Tim Anderson is, and he has a strong social media presence, but he's also been active talking about how a lot of players in Major League Baseball don't really care about social media and don't really care about extending out to other fans, mm-hmm. and that's going to have to change, and because there's not potentially going to be a season this year, they're going to have to be more active on these social media platforms to try and draw in a younger audience. Baseball is an amazing, beautiful game, and if the younger generation is going to get the opportunity to see that, they're going to need to be drawn in the ways that other leagues have done this. The NBA has done a great job with it. The NHL does a good job with it. And yeah, Major League Baseball just has to get on the schneid here.
Yeah. Finally, Aaron, I had a gentleman on the show earlier this week from the World Health Organization, and he gave his, you know, projections for the coronavirus, and he said something, and my mind, after I hiccuped a little, my mind immediately went to you. When he said, get ready for maybe no football for 2 years, college or pro.
Oh, my good. All right.
Now I know you love going with the lady there to like Bed Bath and Beyond and all the candle stores and stuff like that. Are you going to be okay for 2 years?
I mean, to be honest with you, it I was just talking to my lovely girlfriend the other day, and I was telling her, you know, how much I'm missing sports, how much I really wish I could have football back and basketball and baseball. And as I'm sitting here, sitting down in my room, looking at my Jamal Adams jersey, and I'm thinking about no football for even a year, let alone 2 years, and I'm starting to sweat a little bit here, Paul. It's not really hot in my room, but I'm getting cold sweats right now. So I don't know if I really want to deal with that.
Okay.
We don't have to get to that point, though.
All right, we'll let you go. Give your lovely other half my best, Aaron Johnson, who used to produce this program. He's still in the building. He's two doors away from me at the Star 99.9 with Ann and Raven of the Morning. Aaron, thanks so much, man. Be good. Eat up tonight, and we'll talk to you.
No problem, Paul. Thanks for the opportunity, man. Take care.
All right. Be good.
And Kurt Westby, our amazing Commissioner of Department of Labor, will be on board as well to tell you a little bit more about how we're processing the unemployment claims. I'd say his news will be better than what you see here in the daily summary. It's not that the numbers aren't surprising. You know, the number of hospitalizations is pretty much what we've been describing for the last week or so, which is that it's not going up exponentially. It's going up in a linear way, consistently going up, but not exponentially. And that means our hospitals have time to prepare and maintain their capacity, which they're doing. Nobody is being denied. What I meant by that is you'll see that two charts are not filled out. That's for positive cases and tests performed. We're still waiting to get that data back from our out-of-state labs, and Josh assures me we ought to have all that information available to you, you know, by the end of today. We have had some technical issues. Maybe some of you heard we were on CTN earlier, briefly, for our bond commission meeting. That was interrupted by some audio issues, which will be we'll get that meeting going again next Thursday. But the bond commission meeting just reminded me that in the middle of this COVID crisis, our government continues to move forward. And whether it's foster kids over DCF and our need to take care of them, whether it's people with disabilities, physical, intellectual disabilities, our constant obligation to take care of them and proud to do it. Barbara will tell you about our folks in the nursing homes, and they've really stepped forward, by the way, as we find additional capacity and space for folks in nursing homes. 39% of our nursing homes now have somebody who's been infected. We have space to quarantine people within nursing homes, new nursing homes. I'm told to give a special shout out to Waveney and Athena, two of our nursing home providers that have made additional space available now, and really to all the folks in the nursing home community and all of you working in those nursing homes. Thank you. Thank you for what you're doing. I can just turn the page a little bit again on hospitalizations. What you ought to see is probably the bottom graph there. Again, you see that the line is fairly consistent in terms of the number of new hospitalizations, again, which means we've planned accordingly and we have still some capacity. The next chart will show you a hospitalization by county. I don't see anything that is out of ordinary from what we said before. You see 52 new hospitalizations in Fairfield, 38 in New Haven, 8 in Hartford. As Dr. Carter has said a little bit, I think social distancing is working. You see that not only in terms of the number of hospitalizations flattening out a little bit, but also the growth from Fairfield to New Haven to Hartford and then east and west is perhaps not going as fast as we had modeled at one point maybe a few weeks ago, a couple weeks ago. And again, I think that's reflective of the importance of social distancing and what a difference you're making. I would like to describe something else to you. It's on the next chart. And these are COVID cases by ethnicity. And this is really important as we try and target our response and make sure that what we're doing is keeping all of our folks safe. And you'll see here on the chart, it's interesting, first off, in terms of who has been infected by ethnic group. You'll see Hispanics, you know, probably 175 out of 100,000. Whites, more like 100,000. African-American folks here in Connecticut, 200,000. So maybe twice as likely to be infected per person. And Asians, you know, maybe 50. And this is important because I really would want to talk about our underserved communities and what we're doing. And first of all, this is not simply a matter of testing. You may say maybe it'd be even worse if we tested more in Black and Hispanic communities. We're making a very important effort to make sure that people get tested fairly and aggressively on as fair a way as we can. I mentioned to you yesterday talking to the CEO of CVS, the major drugstore company that's part of Aetna family. And they have now committed to setting up two important Abbott Lab 15-minute tests, one in Stanford and one in New Haven. We're going to get that going, I hope, within the next week, 10 days, to make sure that people are tested and know where they stand on a broad-based basis, regardless of whatever community you may be or a part of. Other reasons I think about why you see a higher proclivity for people who are infected by ethnic group, by ethnic communities, and you'll see, sadly, also by fatalities, is just different characteristics. You know, folks in these underserved communities are less likely to be able to telecommute, more likely to be forward-facing, dealing with folks every day, more likely perhaps to be nurses, more likely to be daycare providers, more likely to be a grocery store, you know, folks. They're on our front lines, but it does put them at a little more risk if we don't take care of them every day with the necessary PPE that they need. They're more likely to live in an urban environment. That's what I mentioned when I was talking about getting the testing in Stanford and New Haven, ASAP, pronto. And in urban communities, you'll see the COVID virus spread a little more quickly. We certainly saw that down in New Orleans, for example. And it's just less easy to social distance. And by the way, that's why these numbers broken down by state are not as meaningful. You ought to be really looking at the different hot spots, and you'll find congested areas are a lot more susceptible to the spread. Again, that tends to impact our underserved communities. Many of the folks have bigger families and living in smaller apartments. So it's tougher just to social distance within your own apartment, your own residential dwelling. We are working on that by making sure that we provide additional hotel space or other space for folks in that situation. They have a loved one at home who is either infected or has been exposed to someone who was infected contact. We're finding them space so they don't actually have to be at their residence. We can find them another place that they can go to make sure that they're safe and to make sure that their families are safe. Finally, the folks in the Black and Hispanic communities are much more likely, I'm afraid to say, to have pre-existing conditions. An African American is probably four times more likely to contract asthma or diabetes than their white or counterpart, and similar numbers for Hispanic. And that's why you see the higher infection, and I'm afraid you'll see on the next chart some of the differences when it comes to death by ethnicity, and certainly the Black community has a higher ratio there. Hispanic community a little less, which is sort of interesting when it comes to pre-existing conditions. All right, what can we do about that? We can do a lot about that. Deirdre Gifford, our amazing commissioner over at DSS, the Department of Social Services, doing everything we can to make sure that we can expand healthcare coverage for all of our people, especially folks now in the underserved communities. Medicaid is expanded by about 14,000 people over the last 2 months. There's now a 90-day grace period. We provided a 90-day grace period for folks in health insurance to make sure their health insurance cannot be cut off, in the middle of this pandemic. And it's the same thing for Medicaid beneficiaries. You have a 90-day grace period there. And the other good thing is we're expanding access to Medicaid and expanding access to primary care physicians. And what that means in terms of your ability to get a test if you're not feeling right is conditioned upon expansion of Medicaid and expansion of access to a primary care physician. We've added We have about 100,000 people now on SNAP, which was formerly known as food stamps. And not only that, but Deirdre's also raising the cap on your SNAP benefit a little bit to compensate for the fact that fewer people are working. We want to make sure they have more access to food. Your card, your debit card will automatically see that over the next couple of weeks. I can tell you we're thinking long and hard about the business loans. You know, the bridge loans that we provided, and we've worked hard to make sure that women and minority-owned companies know where they have access to these bridge loans so they can keep their companies going forward. About 20% of the companies that applied for our Connecticut-based bridge loans were women and minority-owned companies, a little better than their proportion within the entire state. We've also been working with HEDCO, which is the Hartford Economic Development Corporation, and have a special program for women and minority-owned companies. You have less than 10 employees. Is that what it is? Less than 20 employees, 0% interest, forgivable loan, targeted on helping you keep your company going, keep your company intact so on the backside of this pandemic you're able to go. And those will be a forgivable loans up to $20,000, targeted again on this underserved community. I'd like to really thank Senators Fonfara and McCrory for helping to take the lead on this and remind us the importance to make sure that our economic aid to our small business include all of our small businesses. I'm thinking a lot about the $1,200 per person grant, $2,400 per couple, plus $500 per child coming from the federal government as soon as next week. And remembering right now, that is conditioned upon you having paid income tax over the last year or two. And then we're also reminded that a significant proportion of our residents don't file income tax because they're not obligated to file an income tax. So I want you to go to the IRS website or to 211.org, and we'll show you how to file your claim to make sure you have access to that same $1,200 grant that helps you, you know, pay for those necessities, you know, right now. Those checks will be coming out very, very soon. Yeah, as you know, we've coming out with an executive order within 24 hours that means that no landlord will be able to initiate evictions for each and every one of you in a rental unit, you know, over the course of at least the next 90 to 120 days. You know what we've done in terms of mortgages, and we have a grace period there. We're providing similar support for people who are renting, make sure that they can rest easy. You know as well that the power company and water company have a grace period in terms of not cutting off any service. That's same for the cable TV companies as well. So you ought to have some confidence that things will hold steady as we get through this pandemic going forward. I should tell you that Kurt Westby will give you a little more detail on our unemployment claims. Those checks are already starting to go out. We're working on a technical fix for the unemployment claims, and I know Kurt will be happy to give you a little more information on that as well. You know, with that, maybe I just ask Barbara to say a few things, if you would, about where we are on nursing homes right now and how we can give people some confidence that their loved ones in a nursing home will be taken care of as safely as we can.
Thank you, Governor. So the department looked at what was happening and how we were addressing the COVID response, and we knew that we needed to look at nursing homes as we developed our medical surge plan. We knew that nursing homes would be an integral part of the plan, and we also knew that there were some challenges with accepting individuals who were hospitalized with COVID-19 into the nursing homes. So I'm here to tell you that nursing homes, the existing nursing homes that we have in Connecticut, are capable. They stand ready to care for your individuals and your loved ones in the nursing homes. But one of the things that they will be looking for, and we have the capacity to do it, is provide two negative tests for hospitalized individuals. And once those two negative tests are identified, the patient will be transferred to the nursing home. We have approximately 2,000 empty nursing home beds in the state. We are working with nursing homes to help them understand what they need to do to care for your loved ones. We are working with them on enhanced infection control strategies and on what staffing requirements are needed. We also have looked at other options in caring for individuals who are COVID positive. So we've looked at two different concepts. We've developed COVID recovery facilities, and in this concept are two nursing homes that will be converted to the care of individuals who are COVID positive. And then we've looked at alternate care sites, which have been previously vacated nursing homes or alternate spaces that have been made available to healthcare facilities to expand to this level of care. So individuals who are in the hospital who previously lived in a nursing home might likely go to one of the converted nursing homes. And then individuals who are living in the community or in congregate settings, and once they recover to the point that they can be cared for in a nursing home, they would go to one of the alternate care sites. And as they progressed and they convalesced and they improved, that particular nursing home would help assist them with community and discharge planning. So we work every day with nursing homes that do have cases of COVID-19 in them. I want to assure you that the department is working very closely on staffing, looking at infection control standards. We're looking at their availability for PPE, and we stand ready to assist them as needed.
Hey, thank you, Barbara. And Kurt, do you want to say just a few more things on unemployment comp?
I'd love to. Do you hear me?
Yes, sir.
We understand it's a financial crisis when any individual is laid off, and we at DOL are doing everything in our power to manage this tsunami of claims that have been submitted. So please be patient as we get to your claims. Once processed, they will include retroactive payments. We already doubled in 1 week the number of UI payments going out. Let me put these burgeoning numbers in perspective. Since March 13th, there have been 302,000 claims submitted. Now that is 2 years of normal claim activity in just 1 month. Of those 302,000, we've managed to process 132,000. Yet, there remains 170,000 outstanding that we're getting at as fast as we can, all using our 40-year-old COBOL computer system. So what else are we doing about it? We've quadrupled staff. We're working overtime. We're working weekends. As a result of that, we've processed 10 times the normal weekly load that our processors would normally process. And all of this while staff are enduring the same COVID threats as everyone else. That's still not enough. We introduced a technical fix number one, where we emailed applicants who had already submitted their claims to resubmit their claims through what we have in our system as a temporary shutdown file, which is completely automated. That yielded another 40,000 more process claims, but that still was not enough. So we're working on another technical fix, Plan B, we call it, which will basically force claims into the automated process. And we're testing that right now, and we hope to have seriously reduce the backlog with this intervention. Timeline on this is hopefully days, and if that works, we'll be able to convert a huge amount of those claims relatively quickly over 2 or 3 days. So in the meantime, for new filers, if you're filing now or in the future, please go to filectui.com. There's a link above the blue button for instructions and a tutorial that we worked out that reads, for quicker payment of UI benefits, please follow these instructions. If you do that, you'll end up in our automated system and you won't have to wait very long. If you've already filed, check your emails daily for updated messages and follow them. Again, we are getting your claims out and processing them as quickly as possible. And with our next technical fix, we expect to drastically reduce the backlog. Please bear with us. Thank you.
Thanks, Kurt. Any questions, Max?
Yes, we're going to open up the questions. We'll first go to WTIC 1080 Radio. Dave, go right ahead. Unmute and ask your question.
Hi, Mr. Governor. Schools at this point are still open until April 20th, but most people are expecting, and you've suggested it could be the rest of the school year. When will that decision be made, and are we getting closer to that?
We're going to make that decision within a week. Obviously, I'd love to open up those schools at some point in June if I could, if I thought I could do it safely. Right now, I'm not sure I can do that safely. We're going to give people guidance within the next week.
Next question will be Christine Stewart, CT News Junkie.
Hey, Governor. Thanks for taking our questions. So the governor of California has struck a deal for 200 million masks, 150 million N95 and 50 million surgical masks per month. Does this mean that the state of Connecticut somehow missed out? And what are we doing regarding the six-state consortium on purchasing?
Well, I'll start out and then hand it over to Josh. But we're working on significant purchases of PPE. We're working with our fellow governors around the region as well. Right now, we have capacity in PPE to take care of most of our frontline responders. We're going to do better on that. And I hope to be able to have some good news for you within a few days.
Well, because of the coronavirus, both Bernie Sanders and Joe Biden have been pretty much off the campaign trail. Both gentlemen are elderly, and they have been social distancing. So once this campaign is written about in the history books, we'll be talking about how the coronavirus affected it. No real surprise that Bernie Sanders bowed out today. He's behind by about 300 delegates, and it would have taken a major shift in the polls for him to really make this a race. So joining us right now, apparently with Joe Biden being the nominee, we think welcome back a return visit for a sociopolitical science professor at Quinnipiac University, Professor Kalila Brown Dean. Professor, how are you?
Paul, I'm hanging in there. How about you?
I'm good. I'm broadcasting good. From my home. So broadcasting from my son's old bedroom when he was just a wee tyke. So.
Wonderful.
Yeah. Look, this didn't come really as a surprise, Professor. You know, the gap that Joe Biden was able to open up on Super Tuesday was pretty much insurmountable. What has Bernie Sanders, do you think, accomplished not just in this campaign, but if you look at his runs over the last 4 years in a cumulative fashion?
I think Sanders' legacy here will be about pushing issues and ideas. Although he is not going to be the nominee, it doesn't, you know, seem that will be the case. The fact that he has forced both Democrats and Republicans to take seriously some of the issues that he has raised. And if we think about that happening in the midst of this pandemic, people started this year feeling pretty secure in their financial standing. They were gainfully employed. They were able to own a small business, to take care of their home, and still put their kids through college. And now here we are 4 months into the year saying, wait a minute, maybe I'm not as economically secure as I thought.
You know, there's...
Go ahead.
No, you finish up. I'm sorry.
No, I was just saying, you know, to think about our state of Connecticut, of people saying, how come I don't have access to testing? I have health care, I have insurance, I pay a lot of money. How come I can't get access to that testing? So those are the kinds of issues that push across party lines and also ideology.
And, you know, there are people I know on both sides of the aisle, especially on the Democratic side of the aisle, the more liberal side, wagging their finger at conservatives saying, see, you know, that $1,200 that, you know, the government's giving out, isn't that kind of a universal income that was championed by Andrew Yang? And isn't this sort of involvement now with businesses? Wasn't that championed by Bernie Sanders at one point? So I see what you're saying here, especially in times of trouble.
You know, the thing I say to my students all the time, Paul, is that everyone hates government until they need government. When you have business owners who are really the backbone of our nation saying, wait a minute, we don't know if we can take care of our families, and now we're also worried about our employees. So that changes the calculus for a lot of people. And even though many people won't be eligible for that $1,200 check, the idea that our federal government is saying we need to infuse cash in order to help people stay in their homes is a very different tone from where we were 4 years ago or even 4 months ago about what we wanted government to do to help us return to some sense of normalcy.
And this professor, this isn't, as I've said numerous times on this show, this is not a natural disaster. This is not a storm or a superstorm or mass flooding or even, you know, God forbid, but even if a city like L.A. or, God forbid, New York or Chicago had a terrorist who set off some sort of a small nuclear bomb, that would be awful. But the rest of the country, you know, they'd stay away from the area. But the rest of the country would somehow, you know, surge ahead and get, you know, daily stuff done. But this is far different from that. Did you ever think you would see the economy essentially turned off for 2 or 3 or 4 months?
Never did I think that we would face this sort of national paralysis. And that's where we are. We're in an economic paralysis. We're in a transportation paralysis. And part of that beauty of the American spirit is that when one area is down, others step up. But this is one where it's really difficult, you know, to think about what sector of our country will be able to restart and jumpstart in order to infuse some sort of energy for other places. And it's also about the long-term consequences of this. The businesses who may not come back, the children whose educational interruption will have long-standing consequences for them and their families. And it's also a moment when I hope that as a country, we'll take a step back and stop being so wedded to party and position and start thinking about people and what it means to invest in the American people so that, you know, God forbid another pandemic comes, will we be prepared to address it head on and to prepare for how we weather the storm together?
Weaving all that in, Professor, with the fact that Bernie has now had two runs and you have some very vocal supporters of him, including, of course, AOC and some of her fellow progressives in Congress, do you ever think that we'll see a day where, as other countries have, there is, for example, you know, a far-right party, a center-right party, a center-left party, and a far-left party? Or are we just too wedded to this, you know, make it as easy as possible form, this two-party system?
I think Americans, we love our tradition and we love our norms. And look, unless we abolish the Electoral College, whoever is the nominee or the nominees in November will need 270 Electoral College votes to win. It is hard enough for a Republican or a Democrat to cross that 270 threshold. It is going to be incredibly difficult. We've never in the history of our country had a third-party candidate come anywhere close to that 270. And if we think about that in the context of COVID-19, think about the populous states that have a lot of delegates in that Electoral College, like a New York, a California. What will it mean if those states are still suffering and people can't get to the polls to cast their ballot? We could end up in 2020 the same way we were in 2016, but for a different party outcome, where the popular vote is different from the Electoral College vote. That's, again, why people, regardless of party, need to think about the rules of the game that we are still beholden to.
Finally, Joe Biden, you know, he has been kept off the campaign trail, of course, for months, or a good couple of months, obviously. He is an elderly gentleman. We all know what this disease does to people over 65 primarily. So was Bernie Sanders. Joe Biden has not really, Professor, been at his best in some of these interviews. You know, there are people saying, oh, Trump would be able to bulldoze him in debates. I don't buy that. I think it'll be a tight race. What do you make of all these rumors that, you know, he should be replaced? He would only be a one-termer. Do the Democrats need some sort of flash-bang grenade to, you know, generate voter enthusiasm? What do you make of all that?
I will simply say that if the opportunity to support yourself and your family is not of enough of an enthusiasm boost, regardless of, again, whatever party people feel, if that is not enough of a motivation to get to the polls, to raise your voice and to vote, then I don't know what will be. You know, if I want to be energized, I go to a music concert or I go to hear the symphony. I can't wait to do that again. I don't vote based on personality. I vote based on what's at stake. And I think, you know, keep in mind, both of our two key contenders, being President Trump and, you know, the presumptive nominee Joe Biden, are over 70 years old. What does that mean for the future of our country, that this is what we are now saying to young people? You inherit the system, and we still want you to participate. And so that, I think, is a broader conversation about what it takes to become a true presidential contender, and perhaps how do we address those barriers so that we see more people seeing public service and political leadership as a path, because we need their energy and commitment.
And, you know, finally, Professor, one other question or one other observation. People always ask me, well, why is that? Why is everybody so old? I say, well, you don't realize, I'm sure you do, Professor, obviously, and you've talked about this, but you don't realize how tough it is to just get on the ballots in some of these states. I tell people of both parties, I have friends, many in both parties, I say, ballot access laws are really controlled with an iron fist by both parties.
And it becomes not about your potential or your promise. It's about who you know. The tremendous amount of money, and this isn't just the national level. This is local and state as well. Tremendous amount of money that it takes to be viewed as a credible candidate. That, I think, is the kind of reform that we all can get behind to say, we want the very best people to represent us, who have our interests at heart, who aren't beholden to special interests, and can afford to navigate a life of public service. My fear is that young people will abandon public service, and we know that is what has carried us through as a nation from the beginning.
Associate Professor of Political Science at Quinnipiac University in Hamden, Professor Kalila Brown-Dean. Professor, take care of yourself, stay safe, and we'll talk down the road. We appreciate it. Thank you.
You too. Stay well.